Cause I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency, radio modulation. The big sound from underground. We bring the truth to places truth is never heard before. We bring the sound communication of our tribal war. Dark vision fly by helicopters in the night. Attempt triangulation of our station in the fight. Straight from the base, deep down, low precision. High crime treason, we broadcast in sedition. Like the Wall Street Morning Afternoon Edition. Commandeering airwaves from unknown positions.
Hi, this is Jonathan Rosenblum, and I am your guest host today, filling in for John Quinlan, who couldn't be here. And you are listening to A Public Affair. And we have a spontaneous show for you today. It's so spontaneous, in fact, that I have just decided to start it because my son Simon, who's turning 16, he turned 16 at 4:30 a.m. this morning. The reason I'm having him try to call in before his Latin class is that Simon was the guest host of 100 middle school classmates. He marched them to the Capitol in March of 2011. During the uprising, when the Act 10 had just been voted on by the legislature, and Simon grew up in the uprising, and he before anybody else knew really what was going on or what was happening, he decided that he should haul his classmates into a march that would meet the high school students at West High and move along to the Capitol. And so he texts me right now and says, I'm in a really noisy place, Dad. So what I need is a substitute 16-year-old to call in and we can talk to him. But, if he doesn't make it in here, here's what our show is today, folks. We are at February 11th today, and the 11th of 2011 is the day that Scott Walker announced, to the public and to the world that Wisconsin collective bargaining for public sector workers was going down. And the response to that was, as we all know, a sort of stunning and powerful reaction, most immediately by teachers and by the teaching assistants at the University of Wisconsin. So what we're going to do today is we're going to play you a piece that described one of the sort of symbolic and substantive moments in the history of this uprising, which was the students arriving and the helium hearts of the rotunda that were launched and that I did a piece on in April of 2011. Then we're going to bring Peter Rickman onto the show. Peter was one of the TAA members, and in a group, they responded to the announcement of Act 10 by bringing thousands of Valentine hearts to the Capitol. And Molly Stentz here had asked me, Jonathan, what in the world does your labor show and Valentine's Day, how are you going to build that bridge? And I think the answer to that is that many of us went through, in some sense, a test of faith, a test of love for our state, for the notion of, in some ways, exile from our state. And so where our hearts were in this was severely tested. And one of the things to emerge from all that heart was a protest movement that is still moving along today. And so we'll be talking to Peter. Peter will also give us an update on the situation of public sector workers and workers throughout the state that he's been organizing on. We will talk to the Interfaith Coalition for Worker Justice, which is about to hold its annual Faith Labor Breakfast, to which, by the way, Sister Simone Campbell of the Nuns on the Bus is going to be here in Madison with the Interfaith Coalition and at several events that you can attend, and we'll tell you about those, and Becky Schiegel of the ICWJ will tell you about those. So that's going to be the bulk of our hour. We're going to have some odd interludes, I'm sure. I've brought a couple of pieces of music that might or might not weave in between the heart, Valentine's Day, labor rights, and I'm going to talk somewhere during this time also about a project that's very dear to my heart that I'm working on, that may be a means of bringing collective bargaining back into the public sector, which is to find ways of dialogue at the level of local groups on the importance of voice at the workplace. So we, in the absence of that kid, and, you know, if you've got a 16-year-old or anyone else, they're never where you need them or want them at the moment you need them or want them, right? Especially not to shovel the walk or put salt down where I slipped earlier today. Okay, enough of that. Let's hit it. Dace, if we could, we're gonna go in with. Let me. I'm looking over at you. We don't. Do we have Edith Piaf? A little heart music. Okay. We're gonna start by. We're gonna put our hearts on our sleeve with a little bit of La Vie en Rose. A little heart music, and then right into the capital heart of the Rotunda. Hit it.
Des yeux qui font baisser les miens, un rire qui se perd sur sa bouche. Voilà le portrait sans retouche de l'homme auquel j'appartiens. Quand il me prend dans ses bras, il me parle tout bas, je vois la vie en rose. Il me dit des mots d'amour, des mots de tous les jours, et ça me fait quelque chose. Il est entré dans mon cœur une part de bonheur, et j'en connais la cause. C'est toi, pour moi, moi pour toi, dans la vie. Alors je sens en moi mon cœur qui bat. Des nuits d'amour à plus finir, un grand bonheur qui prend sa place, les ennuis, les chagrins s'effacent, heureux, heureux à mourir. Parle tout bas, je vois la vie en rose. Il me dit des mots d'amour, des mots de tous les jours, et ça me fait quelque chose. Il est entré dans mon cœur une part de bonheur, et j'en connais la cause.
Okay, so why did you just hear Edith Piaf singing about La Vie en Rose? Well, besides the fact that it is Valentine's Day on Thursday, we have a lot of we have a lot to say about matters of the heart involving labor and labor rights and the second anniversary of the uprising. And in fact, La Vie en Rose was a wartime song that was bringing people back to their hearts after the struggles they went through. And it is not an exaggeration to say that on February 11th of 2011 and then on February 14th, 2011, the matters of the heart blended with matters of labor rights in an extraordinary way that exploded ultimately into rallies of more than 100,000 people at the Capitol. So you are listening to A Public Affair. This is Jonathan Rosenblum filling in for John Quinlan. And we're going to take calls in just a bit. But first, we're going to listen to a piece that describes what happened with the hearts that were brought in thousands on Valentine's Day to the rotunda and to the governor's office when Governor Scott Walker was his office was nearly buried in love for this state as the first explosive reaction to the introduction of Act 10. You know what happened after that. But if you don't, or if you want to talk some more about it, we're going to have Peter Rickman, who appears in this piece, come on live in just a few minutes after it plays. It's about an 8-minute piece called The Capitol Heart. It was picked up by the Wisconsin Historical Society in a piece in their Odd Wisconsin publication. And the heart about which this piece spends time talking about and bringing into focus is actually, at this moment, perhaps still with some helium in it, sitting in the Historical Society archives. We tried to get one of the archivists to call in. We're not having success at that at the moment. But we're going to kick that piece in, spend 8 minutes on that, bring Peter Rickman on, and then with the Interfaith Coalition for Worker Justice. So, Dace is ready. We're going to cue up Capitol Heart. Here it is from
As April. The Capitol Rotunda uprising, now the Walkerville uprising, enters its fourth month, Wisconsin and the world have learned what democracy sounds like. And it shouldn't be surprising that the uprising has given voice to so much spirit of protest, because after all, a big part of it has been about the denial of voice, the denial of the right to collectively bargain. But when hundreds of protesters were evicted from the Capitol occupation in March, and the signs were removed and the metal detectors went in and the ejections from hearings were accelerated, the Capitol Rotunda, that heart of the movement, did become a quieter place. So it's only right for a WORT investigative reporter to go back to ground zero to ask the question, does the voice, does the spirit of the protest still resonate in the heart of the rotunda? You may find the answer somewhat surprising, even mystical.
What are you looking at?
Capitol.
Yeah, it's the Capitol. What else is it?
What do you see up? What are we looking up? The Capitol. What
the
part
red
of
thing
the
looks, The red thing looks pointy to me.
Pointy red thing, okay.
It's a crystal.
You know what this
you
is
think
called?
It's a crystal?
I think it's a big
Capitol. No.
I found Anne-Marie O'Brien, the mother of two children at Oriole Lane Elementary School in Mequon, in their first visit to the Capitol.
Called the Rotunda.
Okay. Who lives
Not
in here?
Not like we learned that in third grade.
So you're going to try and guess at what that red thing is up there?
A crystal.
A crystal, okay. Anyone else guesses?
I'm thinking that a crystal would fall since it's...
Maybe it's glued. What the...
And then Margaret Brackey of Madison.
If you look up, if you look straight up, do you see that red dot up there? Do you have any idea what that is?
I remember that was a Valentine's balloon.
Oh, that's why it was pointy. It was shaped like a heart.
Exactly.
And the bottom of it was pointy.
And so it was that the red balloon was actually a helium heart. And the helium heart had been in the Capitol for 100 days and more. And how did it get there, you ask? Well, let's go back in time a bit. Here's Peter Rickman, a graduate student at University of Wisconsin-Madison, who's a part of the Teaching Assistants Association, the union for the graduate students, and he's addressing a large crowd in front of the Capitol on Valentine's Day, the first day of the protests.
On Friday, Governor Walker decided that he wanted to be a heartbreaker on Valentine's Day.
This isn't a protest. This is to come voice our support, our love for the people that make higher education and public service work in Wisconsin.
And so the crowd entered the Capitol and went up to the governor's office, dumped thousands of valentines on a desk up there, and then went down to the rotunda where heart after heart after helium heart was launched up into the oculus of the dome. And so there was a tremendous amount of energy giving loft to the balloons up into the dome and perhaps giving particular buoyancy to one representative heart over the others. But now let's introduce a little science into this, because according to very authoritative balloon sources, a helium balloon, heart or otherwise, may last a week, a good tie on it, 3 weeks, 6 weeks, okay, not impossible, 12 weeks, highly improbable, 114 days after February 14th, Valentine's Day. So let's bring back one of our local homegrown experts on the subject.
I would not think that a balloon could stay up there that long, but... Just helium. I would think it leaks out. What? Magic, maybe? I don't know how.
Valerie Van Horn was at a recent Rotunda sing-along.
There are all sorts of theories about why it's up there. Some theories are that it's up there keeping an eye on Scott Walker.
Had you noticed it before?
Yeah, I'm actually a member of Capitol Balloon Facebook page.
What?
There's a Capitol Balloon Facebook page.
Are you serious?
Yeah, he's a public figure, the Capitol Balloon. Lisa Wells... put him up there.
As of when?
And she's like, oh, here's the Capitol Balloon. And
so it's
he'll...
now a Facebook page.
Yeah.
Called?
Capitol Balloon. He's a public figure.
So the heart may be a public figure, but not all the time. On weekdays after 6 o'clock and weekends after 4 o'clock, the rotunda is closed except to the Capitol Police. And among the Capitol Police, there is one Sergeant Dave Huxtable, who knows some things that have been going on there that are a little bit unusual, to say the least. Sergeant Huxtable hears my questions from across the rotunda and comes over and starts telling a story about a visitation to the very area that the students and workers had occupied for those weeks.
The helium balloon naturally escapes from the balloon anyway, but at night, as they cool the building... The balloon actually cools down.
Let me get this here. The balloon cools down.
The balloon
and it's going to come down to where?
And then it'll settle down to about the first floor level.
Just right here?
Actually, one floor above us.
So it'll hover.
Yep.
Usually staying in the center.
Well, no, it'll drift off to the side because there's currents in here.
Okay, and you guys get to see this where nobody else does.
Oh yeah, we.
But retrieve. But how does it keep ending up back up there?
Well, if nobody retrieves it, well, then as the building heats the next day, then it'll go
okay.
back.
But that one balloon has been there.
But one thing Sergeant Huxtable can't explain is what is on the mind of this heart. Katie Reeder has been contemplating this.
Another one is that it's just inspiration for us, and our hearts are still here in the Capitol.
All right. Yeah.
He's destroying our state, and they don't care. They have no compassion and no empathy. They don't care.
For Chris Reeder, the heart is all about, well, you know.
I think heart is definitely what's driving it. I mean, there's definitely a push. And I think the reason we come to this sing-along, one of the big reasons is to rejuvenate our heart, to get our strength back, because there's a lot of despair and pain going around, you know, and frustration. So in addition to making sure our voices are heard here, one of the reasons we come here to sing every day is to rejuvenate our hearts, to strengthen ourselves again for the fight ahead, the long fight ahead.
In all the time the heart of the rotunda has been with us, just this is certain. From February 14th to the Fab 14, from the slammed shut doors of the Capitol to the Open Meetings Act arguments before the Supreme Court, to the recall petition certifications, Governor Walker's legislation to silence union voice has never become law. The bill may not have been killed, but curiously deflated. So maybe that's what this silent sentinel is all about, giving loft and lyric to the voice of the people.
If it stays up, then I'm going to say it's a metaphor for the people's spirit of fighting Wisconsin. If it doesn't stay up, then I'll just say, well, it's just a balloon.
So we are back live, and this is Jonathan Rosenblum, the same one who just had the voice on the piece about the heart, which was in particular a piece that brought in Peter Rickman from the Teaching Assistants Association at University of Wisconsin, and which the piece characterized sort of that explosive moment where hearts were raining down and rising up in the rotunda as the public began responding to the imposition of Act 10 on public sector workers in Wisconsin, among many other pieces of regressive legislation in our state. Do we have Peter on the line, live and in not quite person, in Milwaukee now, where Peter is working on union issues? Peter, are you out there?
Hi, Jonathan. Yeah, I'm
hey,
happy to be on.
It's great to have you on, Peter. I don't know if you were able to hear the piece that we just ran. Was that in your ear while we were waiting, or?
It was a journalistic tour de force, Jonathan. I couldn't miss it.
Well, I'm glad you're using the French, Peter, since we, of course, started the show with Vie en Rose. And certainly the labor movement and its energies can also be can be described that much more passionately for Francophiles. But no, seriously, here we are. We are now February 11th, would you believe it, 2013. Peter, what the hell are you doing these days? Tell me what you're up to and give me some reflection on what you were doing 2 years ago, too. But tell me first, because one of the things we want to do here and bring people in to call in, since we've kept them from calling so far, is to update folks on what's happening in the labor movement, particularly in attempts at bringing labor back in Wisconsin.
Well, it's certainly an auspicious, if also infamous, anniversary here today, 2 years on since Governor Walker, as he put it, dropped the bomb. You know, February 11th, 2011, 2 years ago today, was just the latest re-announcement by the right wing and the corporate elite of their one-sided class war, in case folks had missed it, over the last 30 years. And, you know, we're in tough times for the formal union movement, but we've been in tough times for the formal union movement, and it's never been easy for organized labor in this country or anywhere around the world. And so, you know, today, these days, the hearts that matter most, I think, for the future of the labor movement and for workers are those of low-wage folks from around the country, whether it's the Walmart workers who are challenging the largest corporate behemoth on the face of the planet, or fast-food workers who've gone on strike in New York, or retail workers on the Magnificent Mile in Chicago. I think there's, as the L.A. Times put it, rising U.S. labor unrest, and the heart of a new kind of labor movement is starting to beat much stronger, and the courage and audacity and boldness in the hearts of low-wage workers standing up to fight back is impressive.
Now,
we built a union movement in this country, and we built the world's first middle class when we turned, you know, crappy industrial jobs into good union jobs.
So,
and
Peter,
we're working
out
to build a middle class in the union movement by turning crappy service sector jobs into good union jobs.
So that's I get the sense that that's some of what you're doing now, and I think people would be interested in knowing. I mean, sometimes I feel like I'm following you and your work because your own personal, your own experience and the evolution of your thoughts and your work actually reflect the change and transformative nature of the of what we were going through here. So tell our listeners what you were doing in your own work and life on February 11, 2011, briefly, and then what you're doing now. And we're talking sort of about almost the bridge from the shock to the moment of Valentine's Day to what happened next. But what were you doing on that day? As a, what was your status in life and in the world? And then what are you doing now and why?
Well, back 2 years ago, I was a graduate and law student at UW-Madison, active in the Teaching Assistants Association, the nation's oldest, largest, and in my opinion, most important graduate student workers union. And when Governor Walker announced his attack on public sector workers' rights, I'm proud to say that I was, you know, right at the ground level with a lot of other very impressive and inspirational activists come leaders in building a fight back against this and tackling this head on and saying, you know, no more attacks on working people in the state, whether it's public sector, private sector, union or non-union. And I think our union was well positioned at the intersection of public sector workers, low-income workers, students, etc., to be able to fashion a fight back and to take some pretty militant action for what the labor movement has been known for here in Wisconsin. And, you know, it was out of that, again, I think inspirational from the number of people and the kind of people who took action. From that sort of inspirational, bold, militant activity of the first few days of the fight back, that we've started to rise up from the ashes, a new kind of union movement, and that's, you know, where I find myself today.
All right, so look, let me, as I want to get right to what you're doing today, but also get your thoughts on what's happened. We're going to hear undoubtedly over the next few days a lot of reflections and a lot of description of what occurred in that rotunda where I found you on the stairways during the joint finance committee meeting that led to the occupation of a certain room that could keep the uprising going and going. But jump over that. In summary, they got the law through. We were on the defensive. The movement has been pummeled in the sense of the loss of bargaining rights of public sector workers. Crane workers in Manitowoc soon thereafter found their private sector union under attack. The current status of public sector unions is that they're fighting back, but there's been a huge hit. And the law of Act 10 on a state level, state courts, has been declared to be a violation of equal protection of workers, but at a federal level, there is still some support from the world of the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, and therefore that case has kept this bill, this law, alive for Scott Walker. But you moved, in some sense, right into the kind of breach of where private sector workers were hurting and still public sector. So bring me, if you're in mostly the private world now, give me some sense of where you felt the public sector went or was going and how you're watching some of that. And then, yeah, give a sense of what you're up to now.
Well, I think that the public sector unions of this country, definitely here in Wisconsin, had a rude awakening a couple of years ago about the absolute necessity for the whole of the labor movement, but certainly of public sector unions, to dramatically reinvent themselves, reform, and take on a different role. And, you know, for lack of more imagination or being constrained by a horribly repressive political system, public sector unions have been fighting defensively, hoping that electing some Democrats and negotiating contracts would protect members. But I think we've seen that public sector workers, private sector workers, union and non-union, are recognizing the need to form a broader fight back against the forces of austerity, whether it's, you know, busting unions in the public sector and decimating public services by defunding them to give more tax cuts to corporations and the rich, or whether we're attacking the decline in living standards and wages for workers in the private sector. There's going to be no improvement in the lives of workers unless we do change the way that we approach these fights that we have with corporations and big business, the political elite, the politicians they own. And so I don't think you can talk about the public sector and the private sector in the labor movement as so different these days, because, you know, on the negative end of things, both have been under attack for a long time, and to those that it hasn't been evident to, it's, I think, becoming much more clear and prevalent in our day-to-day lives. But on the positive end, too, I think there's been a tremendous amount of developments amongst public sector and private sector unions and our allies and community organizations and elsewhere.
So, Peter, let me jump in.
We're taking up these fights differently and better.
Yeah. But that's absolutely crucial, and your role in this, tell me just nuts and bolts, and then we're going to bring in, if we have any callers, feel free to call 256-2001. We're talking about the uprising. We're talking about the aftermath of the uprising. We're talking about heart. It's near Valentine's Day when Peter Rickman took that megaphone with hundreds of teaching assistants at the Capitol and essentially helped open the doors for the 100,000 to make their way there. Peter, nuts and bolts, who are you working for? What's your goal in the work you're doing? What would you see as some success in that work? Give it a very real nutshell, and let's see if we get in a caller or two with some questions. We have some expertise here and others who can call in too.
Yeah, I I'm working with the Service Employees International Union on a couple different projects, which I think are probably the more important story than anything that I'm personally involved in or what I'm up to individually. It's really about building a different kind of labor movement, you know, one that takes as very real the need to organize low-wage private sector workers and build fights wherever we can in the economic arena, but also building a new kind of political strength for progressives, for labor and community organizations, and build independent politics. Doing more of the same is just going to keep us in the same place at best, and the state of the American worker today is pretty poor. And we need to fight back differently and be serious about taking power. So that means working to elect real champions, not just the lesser of two evil candidates at the ballot box. It means fighting on issues that are you know, gut feel, core level, pocketbook kinds of things like the minimum wage or local living wage ordinances. It means exploring new models for the labor movement and not just looking to the same old version of what a trade union has been for the past 150 or so years. And so these kinds of things are swirling around, and those of us who are working full-time in the labor movement or, as President Obama's staff would call it, the professional left, I think, you know, we're all just working to do whatever we can to figure out new approaches to things and to take up the fights where they are, taking up the defensive fights that we have to have, but turning them into offense to attack the 1% on any number of different levels. And I think folks are doing that not just here in Milwaukee or in Madison or across Wisconsin, but all across the country. And that's what's so exciting right now, is that 2 years on from this unprecedented attack that just sort of became the norm of the political right wing in this country, we're seeing new life to labor and the left in fighting back and winning.
All right, fighting back and possibly winning. Now we're going to get a caller in here. We're going to see if someone's going to either challenge us, support us, or what they've got to say. Caller, you are on the air with Peter Rickman. Jonathan Rosenblum here with you, too.
Great. Thank you so much for this wonderful program. Obviously, Republicans are no friends of the labor movement. But we saw before Governor Walker entered the stage that WEAC, the teachers, and AFL-CIO, and a lot of the big players in the local labor movement, they were backing candidates like Jim Doyle that didn't exactly advance the rights of workers, let alone their quality of life. Don't Democrats sort of have some blame here?
Peter, I'm going to see if you've got some thoughts on that. And then, I mean, obviously one of the things you're out there doing, Peter, is building the grassroots that's going to make their way back into a different political voice. But what are your thoughts on the caller's question there?
To just answer the question directly, absolutely. I think it's a function of the problem that we have with the broader political environment and the constraints that we've had. But just saying the Democrats have, proverbial blood on their hands, and that, you know, they're not much better than the anti-worker Republicans is, you know, that's easy to say. I mean, we can yak all day long on the radio about that. I think the challenge is, what do we do about it to build, an alternative to the Democrats, to challenge the Democrats, to drag them to the left, while defeating the corporate Republicans just the same as the corporate Democrats? And, you know, many of us here in the labor movement and amongst progressives have been trying to figure this out, and I humbly look to the example that's been set by those who've gone before us to plow that field of building independent progressive politics. I think many of us have sort of come to agree that there's a model for doing this, and we should take it up, and it's building independent political organizations that are rooted in, you know, progressive social forces like unions, community organizations, places where people are organized, and that it's not just enough to stand on the sidelines and carp and say that Democrats are bad. And I'm not saying that's what the caller is doing. There's limits to the call-in format here. But I think that what we have to do is work to elect progressive champions, candidates who come from our movement. Means we have to take on issue fights that are about core social and economic justice issues, and link the work that we do in the legislative and issue arenas with our elections activities, and vice versa. And along the way, develop new leaders, people who can stand up to fight for working people. And that means candidates who are from the working class and the poor. It means candidates who are people of color and young. That's how we're going to build a new progressive future, is by standing up and striking out, not necessarily on our own to become an irrelevant marginal force, but being really serious about cultivating the power that we need to effect real change.
Peter, let me jump in and ask you just one real concrete question that may relate to the caller, and that is, you know, when we were amid the crisis of this time 2 years ago, the unions, the public sector unions in particular, had tried to get a bargain through. They had had a contract that actually the Doyle administration had finally agreed to, but the legislature didn't act on it until after the election. Do you have any recollection through TAA or otherwise what your sense concretely of the politics of that moment was, and why it felt so dire in that moment that it took place?
Yeah, I absolutely remember that, Jonathan. It was, I remember watching it actually on my television, watching the vote on Wisconsin I, and just being befuddled first. And I wouldn't say a sense of dread came over, but it was just, you know, like a ton of bricks hitting you, a proverbial ton of bricks hitting you in the face. That's this right-wing reactionary, this guy who's a darling of the conservative movement because he's a true believer and doesn't even need to be bought and paid for by the Koch brothers, was going to be in charge of negotiating with public sector unions. But at the same time, Jonathan, we all knew that we were living in an era where even negotiating contracts with wage freezes and pretty tough economic circumstances for our teaching and project and research assistants or the blue-collar workers on the UW campus or whatever, that our economic circumstances were not significantly improving through that. We were just barely treading water because of the broader political and economic forces. And, you know, I don't think I'm any sort of visionary far-seer when, you know, I understood that the Walker phenomenon was just the latest salvo by the right-wing and corporate forces to attack workers. I didn't expect that Act 10 was going to come down 2 years ago today, but I definitely expected that there were going to be attacks on workers, like I think everyone here in Wisconsin did. That was just one more moment in it, but in a lot of ways it steeled our resolve to fight back, because we knew that this kind of thing would be coming in some way, shape, or form, and that we need to be bold and audacious. And I think it's helped provide a perspective to a lot of people in the labor movement and amongst progressives that we do need to build a politics of by and for working people.
So, Peter, let me jump in here. We're going to have in just a minute, and this segues nicely, the Interfaith Coalition for Worker Justice of South Central Wisconsin is going to come on. But I want to make sure and just underline the caller's point is very well taken, that, you know, things weren't, before Walker, things weren't always in the best of shape for labor either. And the and one of the things that has to come out of our times and our tribulations would be actually a concrete understanding of the kinds of things that did go wrong, of what labor can improve in its own organizing, its own messaging, its own strength, so that folks at the grassroots can deliver their message with some strength, some punch. But they have to get their voices back, and in that sense, there has been a fundamental violation by, and this I'm going to express my own view as a labor attorney, that this state is currently a state in violation of fundamental principles of labor rights, being primarily the right of voice of public sector workers. I'm going to enable other callers to call in a minute, but we're going to have Peter, we're going to say bye to you for now. You're preserved permanently in the archives of WORT on that radio piece, among other things. But we're going to bring Becky Schiegel in, an organizer with the Interfaith Coalition for Worker Justice, who's going to talk about grassroots projects that at this 1 year special meeting of the ICWJ, the Interfaith Coalition for Worker Justice, that organization does, and that I have served on the board of, not now, but working on projects with them now. Becky, are you with us? Peter, take care.
I am, Jonathan.
Take care of that baby. And caller, thanks a lot for calling in. Becky?
Yes.
What are you up to? You're over there at the ICWJ office as we speak, and what are you doing?
I am, and we're very excitingly getting ready for our annual events. This is the 13th annual Faith Labor Breakfast, happening on Valentine's morning, this Thursday morning, at Holy Wisdom Monastery. And we have, along with that event, we have Sister Simone Campbell coming into town, which is just great. And she's going to be hanging out with us for three events.
Now,
Wednesday,
let me just jump in,
Becky. Thursday morning.
If Sister Simone Campbell is not familiar by name to our listeners necessarily, there is one big nun-filled bus that came through Wisconsin sometime back, in particular protesting the Paul Ryan budget during Ryan's sudden sweep into the national picture. So Sister Simone, as I understand it, am I correct, was the driving force, so to speak, for the nuns on the bus.
She was, and she's also been much longer the executive director of NETWRC, which is the main Catholic progressive lobby. And she also recently spoke at the Democratic National Convention and won an international award for her efforts on behalf of democracy.
Now, as international response goes, one cannot help but take a breath. You did not know this when we went on the air, but the Pope has announced that he is resigning, and it was the Vatican that most recently had some things to say about Sister Simone Campbell and NETWRC. In other words, saying that their points of view perhaps had gone too far in terms of various doctrines. I'm not going to call on you as an expert on this, Becky, but this is really an extraordinary moment, an extraordinary person to be coming to Madison to speak at the ICWJ. Tell us what events specifically are going to take place. Who can come to what? Because I understand you are already sold out just for the Faith Labor Breakfast this coming Thursday. But what events will be taking place, when, where, and how can folks learn more about it and join in?
Definitely. So starting Wednesday afternoon, which is Ash Wednesday, we will be at Holy Wisdom Monastery, which is at 4200 County Highway M. And at Holy Wisdom, they'll be having Ash Wednesday liturgy. That's at 3:30. Sister Simone will be giving the reflection, and there'll be a coffee hour, and that's something that anyone can join us for services there with no RCP,
time,
no charge. That night, starting at 5:30.
Becky, what time is the remind me what time mm-hmm. is the Ash Wednesday service with Sister Simone Campbell?
Oh, okay, thanks. 3:30.
Okay, 3:30 at Holy Wisdom Monastery. On Wednesday, on Ash Wednesday, and then there's another event that's very important for listeners who want to have a special a point of contact and opportunity to engage with Sister Simone. What's that?
Definitely, and there is room available. Starting at 5:30, we are going to be at a private supporter's home. Sister Simone will be there, and she will be in conversation with Jean Faraca. They'll be talking about who we are as a nation. John Nichols will be the MC, and this is a smaller setting for folks who literally want to be in conversation with Sister Simone.
And how, if somebody wanted to find out and reach you, maybe even right away, to go to that, which I should emphasize is a very special small gathering and that will cost some bucks to get into, but very, very much worthwhile, especially with Public Radio's Jean Faraca and with John Nichols and Sister Simone, the leader of the NETWRC movement in Washington and of Nuns on the Bus. Who do they contact? How do they do it if they wanted to reach you even right after this show?
Great. Right after the show, they can call me in the office, 255-0376. If they want to get on email, they can contact our director, Rabbi Renee Bauer, and she is director@workerjustice.org. And if they just want to get all the information you just said in front of them in print and details, they can go to our website at workerjustice.org.
By the way, how did you manage to get workerjustice.org in Madison, Wisconsin as the website? Someone was forward-thinking on that, I guess.
Yes, I've always hoped we won't need to ever sell our URL for fundraising. I'm sure it's worth a lot, though.
Yes, we hope that would... we wish to hold. So what other, along with Sister Simone coming in, and we've said that she's going to do Ash Wednesday service, then the special event, and then Thursday morning is sold out for the the Faith Labor Breakfast. Give me a quick summary of some of the other work the Interfaith Coalition for Worker Justice is up to.
Sure. Well, our biggest recent event, and the, project that's still going on is the Just Dining Project. We released, along with the Workers' Rights Center, the very first dining guide to Madison, and we are still selling copies of that. They can reach us here for that also. Just Dining is the first time. You know, we have a lot of foodies in Madison, and we do a lot about where does the food come from? What is the quality of the food? Is it organic? Is it local? But this is the first time somebody's put out a guide and drawn attention to what's happening for the workers who make and serve the food and clean up after us in the restaurants.
And I've understood, because this was the 10th anniversary also of the Worker Rights Center, that of people who have come in to seek help, to who've had their wages stolen, that this has been a huge and important kind of both study and focal point for the community.
Sure. In terms of people coming in and being served by the Workers' Rights Center, restaurant employees are the largest sector. It's also true just nationally that if you look at the 10 lowest-paying jobs in the whole country, over half of them come from the restaurant industry.
Yeah.
And the good thing about the guide, when you pick it up, it's not just a guide, but it gives you a lot of information about what are those things we don't know about restaurant work.
That's great. We've got a caller, I think. I've got a signal from our engineer here. So let's bring this caller on, and we'll have a little chance to talk here on public affairs. It's Jonathan Rosenblum with Becky Schiegel of the Interfaith Coalition. We're filling in for John Quinlan. Here we go. Caller, we got somebody on here?
Hello?
Hi. Come on. Tell us. What's up?
Wisconsin Wave is having an interesting day over at Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce come Wednesday. It's supposed to be kind of nice but breezy out, and I was wondering if it would be okay at this point in the program to mention that. Are you familiar with Wisconsin Wave and the Wisconsin?
We are. Just give us, since we have very little time, tell us the nuts, just the nuts and bolts. Give us the details. And
at 9 a.m., again at noon, and again at 5 p.m., we'll be at the Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce pointing out the real bad guys behind the puppets. These causes are actually all one big cause, and I hope I'm not interrupting about the Workers' Justice Center.
We'll get that in again, but
thank you very much for your time.
No, thanks for coming on. We do have just a few minutes left, so if there are any other callers out there who would like to either vent about the Wisconsin uprising, about how your heart feels today as you're dealing with the question of the state of public sector unions and private sector unions in Wisconsin, we have Becky Schiegel, who I'm going to keep on the line here in case anybody does call, and otherwise I'm going to go into my own little pitch for what I think the Interfaith Coalition for Worker Justice in particular has meant to Wisconsin, and what kinds of impacts at a time where, you know, what we do next may literally spell the difference between an effective not only labor movement but voices at work, where workers have been denied their voice, Becky. And this has been going on for a long, long time, obviously. But the trend here in Wisconsin is one that is of individualism, of largely of self-interest, of the notion that that favors will go through taxes and otherwise to business, but that workers themselves should have less voice. And so I don't see that we have a light on the phone, so we're going to continue with the light of what otherwise we see as guiding us in this moment at February 11th, 2013, 2 years after the uprising began. So a project that I am working on that I would love to have others call in or either contact the station to engage with me on this. But over the next few weeks, I will be engaging in a project in which we'll be looking in particular at both successes and failures in bringing back the fundamental protections of collective bargaining and freedom of association in various states. And we are looking for ways of doing that here in Wisconsin, whether it's through grassroots dialogue at the level of churches and faith groups about what it means to have speech and the right to associate. But then what happens at work? We know that the Catholic Church, that's about to bring in and to determine a new pope, has actually had among the most progressive statements in the interfaith community that have been heard. The Catholic Church's support has tended to be strong for labor rights, but took a step back, a serious and difficult step back here in Madison, in the diocese in particular, which was very difficult for many of us to understand. The Jewish community didn't necessarily come to the conflict with a solid voice that one would traditionally expect to hear on behalf of worker justice. There were individual congregations, but not necessarily a voice of the Jewish community. There were marches, there were vigils, there were individual churches that came out. But what of the actual debate and dialogue about worker justice and about bringing collective bargaining, which really is voice, back? Petitioning is what it's about. And I'm hoping through this study that we're doing and that the Interfaith Coalition for Worker Justice is in fact supporting, that we will be able to engage this question of faith group petitioning, which may sometimes be freedom of association in order to have the right to pray or to meet or to gather. But that question of voice extends well beyond that space, and it's the same voice that workers in petitioning their government have now been denied. Becky, I'm torturing you now with my soliloquy on this, but is that why the ICWJ in some sense exists? What are we doing to organize and get that word out there?
Right. I think what you point out is really important, the idea that this is not a new thing, that religions, you've mentioned a couple of the mainline groups, but across the board, faith groups have been heavily involved in workers' rights throughout history, and including in this country, and we've sort of selectively forgotten that and not sometimes seen that as a place where religious groups get involved. But actually, as you mentioned, there have been statements from the Vatican and from the heights of other religions about the fact, seeing the right to get together and speak for yourselves as workers as a human right.
Well, I really appreciate those last. We're going to give you the last word on that, in fact, Becky. And remember, folks, contact the Interfaith Coalition for Worker Justice, 255-0376. We are going to leave this show now with, if Dace has this queued up, a famous tune from the 1960s by Sister, this was by the Singing Nun, and it's the song Dominique, and we're signing off. We'll look forward to checking in with you all soon. Give us a call when you can on labor rights.
Dominique, nique, nique, s'en allait tout simplement, routier, pauvre et chantant. En tout chemin, en tout lieu, il ne parle que du bon Dieu, il ne parle que du bon Dieu. Certains jours, un hérétique par des ronces le conduit, mais notre père Dominique par sa joie le convertit. Dominique, nique, nique, s'en allait tout simplement, routier, pauvre et chantant. En tout chemin, en tout lieu, il ne parle que du bon Dieu, il ne parle que du bon Dieu. Ni chameau, ni diligence, il parcourt l'Europe à pied, Scandinavie ou Provence, dans la sainte pauvreté. Dominique, nique, nique, s'en allait tout simplement, routier, pauvre et chantant. En tout chemin, en tout lieu, il ne parle que du bon Dieu, il ne parle que du bon Dieu.